It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We continue our WPR news series on the Affordable Care Act in Wisconsin. Under the act, states had big choices to make. Some mostly blue states have fully embraced the law, while other mostly red states have resisted its implementation. But Wisconsin's Republican majority took a unique approach. They publicly turned down parts of the law while using it to expand state-run health care at the same time. Rich Kramer reports.
Walker refused to set up a state-run health insurance exchange and turned down a federally funded expansion of Badger Care, the state's Medicaid program. It may sound like Wisconsin is dragging its feet, but the Walker administration has embraced the Affordable Care Act in a few key ways. First, the governor expanded Badger Care to those making less than $11,000 a year. Department of Health Services Deputy Secretary Kevin Moore says now nearly 82,000 new people will be covered by the state, and they're counting on the new health insurance exchange to pick up around 77,000 losing their Badger Care coverage.
And so if you take a look at the continuum, because of the governor's reforms, people that live in poverty will have access to Medicaid, and those above poverty will have access to affordable health insurance through the marketplace or exchange.
But there are trade-offs. Since Walker expanded Badger Care while turning down the federal expansion money, it'll cost the state nearly $340 million over 8 years. But Moore says it ensures the state won't get stuck with the bill if the feds break their funding promise. Critics like David Reamer of Community Advocates, though, are concerned about more than money. He's worried many losing Badger Care won't sign up on the federal exchange.
My prediction is that unless we do something quite dramatic and clear to make it a lot easier for them to sign up, I think that 50% of this group that's supposed to transition from Badger Care into the Obamacare exchange are just going to drop out. They're going to disappear, become uninsured again.
To keep that from happening, Governor Walker did what many Republicans are hesitant to do. He expanded government by adding 88 employees and is spending nearly $78 million on health care education to help transition people to and from Badger Care. Most of the staff will work in Milwaukee, while 18 will be based in Madison, assisting county health departments. Walker says his administration has also been training nonprofits and others on how to help people make their health care decisions.
We've worked diligently for the past several months to make sure that we've got over 1,500 partners across the state. We've been working with stakeholders from hospitals to health care providers to nonprofit groups to public health departments to make sure the people of this state who are eligible for the health care exchanges know what they are, know what their options are.
Perhaps it's ironic then that even though an opponent of the Affordable Care Act like Walker added dozens of state employees and is spending tens of millions to make it work for Wisconsin, the success of it all now rests on a glitchy federal website. Wisconsin Hospital Association Vice President Eric Borgerding calls it a waiting game.
The proof will be in how many people actually enroll in coverage in the exchange. And at this point, you know, we could have the best enrollment network in the country, but if you can't get actually enrolled, it doesn't really matter.
Borgerding is hopeful that the website will be fixed, but he says there's another looming concern for hospitals, the state, and federal government. That's whether people who likely haven't had health insurance before will keep up with payments.
Getting people enrolled is one thing, and clearly that's proving to be a daunting task. People maintaining that coverage is going to be a whole other ball of wax, and we're as concerned about that as we are with enrollment.
Though the federal website may be stuck, the clock is still ticking for the state to get more than 160,000 people signed up for Badger Care or private insurance on the new exchange. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Rich for that report.
We're going to stay with the Affordable Care Act now. Our next guest is worried about the troubled rollout of the website, and he says it's a sign of problems to come. Joining us is Ira Stoll, editor of futureofcapitalism.com, author of the new book JFK Conservative. His piece, The Obamacare Disaster Has Arrived, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Ira, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So you have wider concerns about the Affordable Care Act, and we'll get into that. But I want to start with the website in the news this week. What do you make of the now well-known troubles with healthcare.gov?
Well, it's pretty astonishing, right? I mean, the government supposedly spent $634 million taxpayer dollars on this website, whereas the Obama campaign in 2012 spent about $11.3 million for what was widely hailed as a very successful technological effort that took in lots of campaign contributions and helped get people to the polls using Facebook and Twitter. It's a huge amount of money, and you know, somehow people managed to buy homeowners insurance. We managed to buy auto insurance. We managed to compare cell phone plans or cable television plans, which Obama is often comparing health insurance to, without a $630 million government website to help us shop for those things.
And the president on Monday said he was upset, as the rest of us were, with the rollout of the website, but they're working to get things fixed and have it up and get people enrolled by the deadlines on December 15th, mainly. Do you share a sense of optimism that they could get it fixed by then?
I don't really know. I you know, even if they get it fixed, they've lost a kind of they failed the launch, you know, and it's going to take a lot of time to try to get all the people who looked at it or tried to look at it in the first place back to the site and to have them have the confidence to go on there and purchase health insurance, which, of course, if people fail to do that, if the healthy 20 and 30-year-olds don't buy health insurance, these exchanges are going to be left with the sickest and most expensive patients, and healthcare is going to end up being even more expensive, whereas this thing was originally set up to try to save people money and save the taxpayers money.
Now, you see, I think, the website as more of a symptom of a more fundamental problem with this approach to healthcare. Can you talk about what at the core you're worried about with the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it seems like a top-down, big government, central planning approach, rather than letting individual companies or private associations or even state or local governments take the lead and experiment and see what works, see what doesn't work, let things go by trial and error. You have this one federal website, which you know, in part because some states have chosen not to do their own websites, is bearing the whole burden of success for this program. And, you know, the same thing is happening with the benefits in these insurance plans. President Obama likes to talk about how birth control is going to be free. Well, what if you're not trying to have kids? I mean, what if you are trying to have kids? You know, there's nothing about fertility treatments in Obamacare. What if you're so old that you don't need birth control, or what if you're not in a relationship where you need birth control? Another thing he talks about is mammograms. Well, what if your healthcare needs involve an MRI every year instead of a mammogram, which is kind of old technology anyway? The cutting edge technology is MRIs. So just like you have the federal government setting up this one big website that's supposed to help everybody shop for health insurance, you have the federal government in Washington basically deciding what's in everybody's health insurance plan. Whereas I think individuals or states or voluntary associations might do a better job of this if they were left to their own devices without so much strict regulation from Washington.
Well, the case made for especially the healthcare exchanges part of the Affordable Care Act is that there's a chunk of people out there who have no healthcare coverage or effectively none, and now they're going to have some, even if it's not perfect. Is that a good at least halfway goal or no?
Well, you know, some of these people may actually already qualify for Medicaid, which is the healthcare program for the poor. They just haven't signed up. Others may be illegal immigrants who don't qualify for Obamacare anyway. And others may be healthy 20 and 30-year-olds who, you know, if they come down with a serious medical problem, in some states may be able to sign up for health insurance if they need it, but otherwise they're just making a calculated decision that they don't think they're going to get sick or have health problems, And if they do, you know, they're gonna take that risk rather than pay money for health insurance that they don't particularly need.
We're talking to Ira Stoll. He's editor of futureofcapitalism.com, author of the new book, JFK Conservative. His piece is what we're talking about. It's The Obamacare Disaster Has Arrived. We have a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we want to hear from you on this one. Are the problems with the healthcare website a sign of deeper problems with the Affordable Care Act, do you think? Or do you see these as early stage wrinkles and that things will get better? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to the founder of the website Jezebel about their new encyclopedia of lady things.
First, we continue our conversation with Ira Stoll about the Affordable Care Act. He says this month's website problems are just part of what he calls an Obamacare disaster. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. We'll go right to the phones. We have Dan with us in Menominee. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much. So I just have a couple of comments to point out. One is that problems with the website don't necessarily indicate a problem with the program itself. I mean, the website was subcontracted out, albeit at maybe too much of a cost, but it's not indicative of what the government is going to do. It's like saying, you know, the movie preview didn't load for this, so the movie is going to suck. It's a non sequitur. And second, the healthcare exchange kind of seems like a capitalist dream to me. I mean, I've always had health care either through my employer, and it's what they chose, or I've had to go to the state. And now it seems like with the exchange, I actually have options, and private companies can compete for my dollar. And isn't that the way capitalism is supposed to go? Thank you much.
Thanks, Dan. Let's tackle that second point first, Ira. There's more competition, at least for some people. They have more choices now, he says.
Well, you know, that would be good, except that in a lot of states, there's already one or two really dominant health insurance providers, and some insurers have stopped offering coverage in certain states. They've just pulled out of certain states because the benefits required under Obamacare are so great, and they have to issue insurance to everybody who wants it. So they are afraid they're not going to be able to make money under these conditions. So I think the danger is that rather than increasing competition, what you're going to see is there's going to just be a few very dominant big health insurance companies in America, the Blue Cross and Blue Shields, the Aetnas, who President Obama in a White House town hall on healthcare assured people that the Aetna stock price was going to do well under Obamacare. And those companies all have, you know, huge Washington lobbying operations, and you know they're not always very customer friendly. So, you know, the small insurance agents who might know the people in the community, and the your hometown doctor who, you know, used to have one office or maybe him and his partner, are going to be replaced by not just huge insurance companies, but, you know, huge groups of doctors which may have less personalized care, maybe a longer wait to see your doctor. You may end up seeing a nurse practitioner instead. So you're going to see a lot of consolidation in healthcare, in part because the federal government is such a big player. You need to have a lot of big clout to deal with that.
Wasn't that all kind of happening already? I mean, the personal family doctor hanging up their shingle was kind of a thing of the past a few years ago, wasn't it?
Well, actually, I think as recently as a couple of years ago, more than 50% of the doctors in America were in one or two doctor practices. So, you know, obviously it depends on the region. Some regions and there are certain can be advantages to that for patients if they're in a multi-specialty group practice. They can get an easier referral to a specialist. But you know, what we're seeing in states like Massachusetts, where Romney Care is kind of an early model for Obamacare, is there's a really long wait to get an initial appointment with a general internist, and and a lot of them aren't even taking new patients.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Juanita in Eau Claire. Juanita, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment that I am a 29-year-old in good health, and I do feel that it is my responsibility to get health insurance. However, it's not provided by my job. I actually work for the state, but I only have a half-time position, so I do not have the option for it. I do not qualify for BadgerCare, and there is a ridiculously long waiting list for BadgerCare anyways. So I'm happy to go onto this website. I don't mind that there have been delays. Healthcare up until this point is much more of a disaster than a change could be. I just feel that there's potential for this to be a solution, and we could not continue going on the path that we were on.
Juanita, thanks for the call. So, Ira, one evidently young, healthy person planning to sign up. Do you think that there will be a lot more like her?
Well, I don't know. It wasn't clear from what she said whether she actually succeeded in buying health insurance through this website. I think what we've seen is a lot of people going on and shopping, and a lot fewer people actually buying the insurance. She also didn't say whether she has health insurance now, or it wasn't clear to me. If she doesn't have health insurance now, you know, what does she do for health care?
Oh, she's off the line, unfortunately. I wanted to ask, actually, before this half hour passes, there have been calls this week for Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius to resign over the website issue in particular. Do you think she should? Should she take some of the responsibility for the website rollout?
I'd like to see her try to fix it. I think the responsibility in the end here is President Obama's, and you know it's Obamacare, not Sebelius care. And I think if he can't turn this into a success, I think there's going to be a real political price to pay, both for the Democratic Party in the 2014 midterm elections and ultimately in the presidential election in 2016, provided the Republicans can offer some sort of alternative, other than just saying, we're against Obamacare.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Ken in Kenosha. Ken, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just had two comments, actually. One was what your guest spoke about 5 or 6 minutes ago, saying that, mammograms are included, but, MRIs aren't necessarily, and, that decision should be made at some lower level than the federal government. All that really provides is a floor of minimum services that need to be provided. There is no law that says that you could not choose a health insurance plan offered by some private company on the exchange that does include MRIs for mammograms. That is, all they're doing is setting a bottom floor, and frankly, I was shocked at how many existing policies don't meet that incredibly basic and really rather low floor. And secondly, in terms of this being Obamacare, it's not Obamacare, it's the ACA. And if everybody would remember that Obamacare was coined by Mitt Romney himself in 2007 in the run-up, to the 2008 election. So that is, a bit of shooting themselves in the foot, I would think. Obama's embraced it, but this is the ACA. This is a federal government thing. And one last thing.
Well, actually, we'll cut you off at two there because we're pretty short on time. So he's saying the first point he made, that mammogram requirement, it's a floor, it's a minimum. It's not saying you can't cover the MRIs you were talking about earlier, Ira.
Well, there's a penalty under Obamacare, this so-called Cadillac tax, where if you buy a more expensive plan that does cover things like MRIs, the government slaps, I think it's a 15% tax on it, as a way of discouraging people from having these better plans. So I think, in a way, this floor that you talk about, it ends up becoming a ceiling almost intentionally because of the attempt to do cost control. And that's not a lot of consolation to somebody who's stuck paying $4,000 or $5,000 out of their pocket for an MRI that their doctors says they need, but their insurance doesn't cover because some bureaucrat has said, well, we're only going to do mammograms.
In our last 30 seconds or so, Ira, Republicans in Congress had wanted a delay of the exchanges. Do you think that should have happened or should still happen, delay it for a year or more?
Well, even the White House spokesman, I think, said a day or two ago that we're not going to impose penalties on people for not buying something that that it's impossible to buy because the website doesn't work. So, you know, we'll see if they can get this working relatively rapidly. And if they don't, I think it's not just going to be the Republicans calling for a delay. It's going to be the Democrats who have already delayed the business mandate. And, you know, they'll be otherwise they'll be taxing people for failing to buy something that it's impossible to buy.
Ira, thanks for joining us today. That was Ira Stoll, editor of Future of Capitalism, author of JFK Conservative. We've got his piece on the Affordable Care Act linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we talk to the creator of the website, Jezebel. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In 2007, the popular new media site Gawker launched Jezebel.com, a sassy feminist website dedicated to women's issues.
The project, spearheaded by founding editor Anna Holmes, was hugely successful. It spawned a wave of new websites that speak mainly to younger women.
Anna Holmes and her Jezebel team are now bringing their project to print with The Book of Jezebel, an illustrated encyclopedia of lady things. It incorporates opinions and facts and charts over 1,000 topics from the word sassy to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Anna Holmes is in New York City, and she is a writer and editor, creator of Jezebel.com. And Anna, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So where'd you get the idea for creating Jezebel.com the first time?
I don't know that I had the idea. I was asked to help create what Gawker Media, the parent company, was calling Girly Gawker. So they wanted to create a women's site. I wouldn't take credit for the idea of a women's site, but I certainly, you know, along with the staffers that I hired, we decided to go in a certain direction, which was that we were going to acknowledge that women are interested in the kind of more superficial things that they're always being fed by traditional mainstream media like celebrity and fashion, but that they also are just as interested in issues of politics, you know, domestic politics or international politics, gender politics, feminism, you know, what have you. So we decided that we were going to, you know, do the fashion celebrity thing, but do it in a smart way, which is to say, not tell readers what to buy, not instruct them that they needed to lose weight or look a certain way or find a man or keep a man, but we would also, you know, cover things like politics, and we did that with the 2008 election, which the readers really loved.
And did you sense when you were brought on board that there was a gap, a Jezebel-sized gap?
You know, it's funny because I was a consumer of the internet, which is to say that I certainly read blogs and some traditional news media outlet websites, but it didn't seem like there was any really. There was a women's website that spoke to me or my peers. At the time, I was 34. I'm now 40. There were women's websites, but they tend to be really, really, really broad in scope, no pun intended, like iVillage, which I don't know how you would describe iVillage other than there was content for quote-unquote women on there, but it was just kind of nebulous and vague and hard to define. And I had worked at women's magazines and celebrity magazines for many, many, many years before I started the site, and so there was a certain frustration that had been built up within me, both as a consumer of that sort of media, but also as a producer of content for that sort of media, that it was just kind of one note and didn't recognize or acknowledge the diversity of women's interests. So when we started the site, we were just kind of doing a site that we thought we would want to read, and hoped that other young women felt the same way and would flock to it, and they did, which we feel really lucky about.
And I want to talk about the name Jezebel. It seems like you're making a point there. Who is the Jezebel in the title of your magazine?
Well, I didn't come up with the name. There was a long discussion about what the site was going to be called a few months before it launched. I believe it launched in May of 2007. So this was probably about
March or April. And we were all throwing names around, and it had to be something that was memorable, that was fairly short, you know, so you could type it into your internet browser. And, you know, we'd come up with a lot of kind of made-up names that might be somewhat memorable. And somebody, I believe it was Gabby Derbyshire, who was the chief operating officer of the company, the highest-ranking woman there, had suggested Jezebel, and I didn't like it. And it's hard for me to explain why, even now, why I didn't like it. I guess it felt to me like it was somewhat obvious, you know, that we were going to pick a word that meant something historically, quote unquote, bad, and like reclaim it as good. But for some reason, I just didn't like it. But I was overruled. You know, it was my site in the sense that I ran it, but I certainly didn't own it. And for a long time, like a good 6 or 7 months after it launched, when people would ask me what I did, I would say I kind of hedge or try to avoid saying the name because I hated it so much. So I would say things like, "Well, I run a women's website for Gawker Media," and you know, inevitably, someone would say, "Well, what's it called?" And so I'd have to just come out with the name anyway. But I really cringed at the name for quite a while.
Yeah, naming stuff is hard, as we discovered when we started our radio show. So there is a perception in popular culture of feminism. You encounter it a lot. It's dour. It's humorless. And this is something that people have been talking about for decades.
Sure.
Do you think you've changed that discussion with Jezebel?
I think that we have changed it. I don't know that we've changed it like across the board, but I do think that there are a lot of young women, and when I use the phrase young women, I'm really referring to like anyone between, let's say, 18 and like 50. You know, I mean, it's a pretty broad demographic. But I think that there are a lot more young women who, I think, by the example, not just of the site's writers, but also its readers and commenters, who, you know, who have come to see that the idea of what feminism is pretty simple, and I don't think it's that controversial. You know, the idea of the desire to have equality between the sexes, you know, and economically and politically, socially, is not something that you would think that most people would take issue with. But, you know, historically, it had been made into a bad word or a bad concept. So we felt when we were doing the site, that if we talked about feminism in a very matter-of-fact way, a very unapologetic way, that we embraced it, you know, both the concept but also, you know, embraced ourselves as being feminists, that maybe some of the stink that had been rubbed on to the word or concept might get washed away a bit, and that even, you know, the particularly younger readers, by which I mean, you know, like the 18-year-olds, would see by example that there wasn't anything really controversial or scary at all about an interest in equality and in gender politics, and that we could, you know, talk about those things 1 minute and then, you know, squeal over a cute puppy picture, you know, 10 minutes later. So that there wasn't this kind of scary it wasn't as scary or reactionary necessarily as they'd been taught to believe, just in kind of, you know, through society. I had certainly grown up, and I was born in the early 70s, and I'd grown up in a household that was very feminist, and I had never felt that it was something to be ashamed of or to turn away from. But not, you know, a lot of people didn't grow up in environments like that and weren't marinating in you know, discussions of gender politics. And I knew a lot of those people who didn't and who rejected it as a descriptor. And so I just kind of we just wanted to make it friendlier, but just again show by example that young women, you know, are diverse and many young women call themselves feminists, and they do not look like a stereotypical Rush Limbaugh type.
And do you think young women are buying this? Because there have been some young feminists who say, yeah, we actually need a new word for this because the old word is not working out for us. People do have these negative associations. Do you think that Jezebel has made it kind of okay to be a feminist?
I think for some people, yeah. For a lot of the readers, I think so, that has. And I've heard I've heard things to that effect. I mean, whether it's people who emailed in or people who've commented on the site or people I've met in person. I'm not going to make any, you know, grand pronouncements about how it's affected, you know, young women in America, because, you know, I'm not sure what percentage of young women in America, you know, read the site or know that it exists. But I think that there has been a really impassioned reaction to the site and an embrace of the idea of calling oneself a feminist. I don't know what word would suffice. Like I'm not sure like what kind of replacement word would be a good one. And I don't believe that there actually needs to be one. I just think that it needs to be reclaimed, you know, quote unquote.
Well, let's get into the Book of Jezebel. It's written as an encyclopedia. It's serious. It's zany. Sometimes in the same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
What were you setting out to accomplish with this?
You know, we had just talked about extending the brand of the site to like another media platform, and you know, we thought about books. So I came up with a couple of ideas of maybe of like a Jezebel book, and a couple, you know, they didn't all sound right, and I had great feedback from both the people higher up at Gawker Media, but also the agent who was working with us. And then I thought, you know what? We need to do a book that kind of encapsulates like the worldview of the site and its readers. And I personally really like reference books. Like I like sitting down and reading encyclopedias and dictionaries and atlases. And so I decided to do an encyclopedia that would, you know, be a look into the sensibility of the site through, you know, about 1,000 entries, you know, as you said, ranging from Sassy magazine to Zygote.
I loved Sassy magazine, by the
way.
That brought back a lot of memories.
It was very important in my development as an adolescent. And I think, you know, I think that was the case with a lot of the writers on the site. And so maybe we were trying to channel, you know, our love of Sassy into this kind of new web venture when it started. But I thought it would be a fun thing to have an encyclopedia as opposed to, let's say, doing a book that was reprinting posts that appeared on the site. Because, you know, you can always just go on the site and read them. And there's been some great, great material on the site, but I just didn't think it needed to be collected into a bound volume. I wanted to do something that was original, that hadn't appeared on the site before. So that was the idea that everyone kind of, you know, liked and agreed to do, and that's what we ended up doing.
I like that there's such range in the book. Now, you have something funny like a sensitivity chip, and there's a picture of Brad Pitt, and it says this guy doesn't have one,
yeah,
with a particularly dull look on his face. It's really,
yeah,
funny. And then you've got kind of a reframing of Clytemnestra and the Greek myth, and I thought that was really interesting. Can,
mm-hmm,
you tell us about that one?
About Brad Pitt?
Brad Pitt, about Clytemnestra.
I'm going to have to grab the book and open it up to look at it because there's so many.
There's a lot of things in there.
Forgotten.
Well, you're telling it, you're retelling it from a feminist point of view. Whoever wrote that entry is writing about how her daughter was killed and she responded by stabbing her husband.
Yeah, yeah.
And that this was eventually Athena upholds patriarchy, and
mm-hmm,
it kind of makes you look at it in a new way.
Well, we tried to, you know, bring a sort of feminist sensibility to every entry in the book. And I mean, when you mentioned sensitivity chip, I mean, that was kind of like a joke entry. Like it didn't have to be in the book, but it was one of those things where we thought that would be funny, and I found a funny picture of Brad Pitt to put alongside it. But we wanted to bring the site's sensibility to basically everything, and in some cases, that's, as you said, like a reframing of a historical figure or event, and sometimes it's a very obvious take on someone that the site dislikes, like Phyllis Schlafly. You know, like, you know what you're going to get when you see that there's an entry on Phyllis Schlafly. You're not, you know, it's not going to be a surprise that she's not exactly beloved by the site's writers.
Well, right now we are talking to Anna Holmes, the founding editor of Jezebel.com. The Book of Jezebel, an illustrated encyclopedia of lady things, came out yesterday. And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think feminism needs a new sassy voice like this? And if you were going to make an encyclopedia of lady things, what do you want to see in that book? What would you include? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We'll be back with Anna Holmes in just a few minutes. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Thank you to the corporate sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Spruce Tree Music and Repair, Pabst Theater, and Sprint Print play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor.
Wisconsin Public Radio's audio archive is an endless stream of knowledge and entertainment. Find what you're looking for or discover something new. Start listening now at WPR.org.
Tomorrow morning from 9 to 11, it's On Point After 10, from Gone with the Wind to Django Unchained to 12 Years a Slave. On Point looks at the evolving depiction of slavery in American film. That's tomorrow morning after 10.
Now we've got a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
The White House says President Barack Obama has assured German Chancellor Angela Merkel that the U.S. isn't listening in on her phone calls. White House spokesman Jay Carney says Obama and Merkel spoke by the phone today. Germany says Merkel initiated the call after receiving information that U.S. intelligence may have targeted her mobile phone. Britain's three-month-old future monarch, Prince George, has been christened with water from the River Jordan at a rare gathering of four generations of the royal family. The 87-year-old Queen Elizabeth was joined by three future kings, Prince Charles, William, and, of course, little George, at a private affair today at the Chapel Royal at St. James Palace. Menominee Tribe and Hard Rock International leaders say they told Governor Scott Walker that they have met his criteria to approve a new casino in Kenosha. Walker plans to announce his decision by the end of the week. I'll have more news coming up at 5 o'clock.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're speaking with Anna Holmes, founding editor of Jezebel.com, and she's a big part of the new book, The Book of Jezebel, an illustrated encyclopedia of lady things. That came out yesterday. It's set up as an encyclopedia, A to Z. Anna, I wanted to hear what's one of your favorite entries in The Book of Jezebel?
You know what's funny? I spend so much time staring at the text that it's all a blur, and I'm not sure I have a favorite, but I do have like a favorite entry that's more of an illustration, the crazy cat lady illustration. I really like the idea of crazy cat ladies because I kind of consider myself one, even though I only have one cat. The cats are really popular, at least on the internet. And so we had an illustrator named Wendy McNaughton who had just finished a book about cats, actually, with her girlfriend or her wife. I'm not sure if they're married, but I should say wife. They live in San Francisco, and Wendy is also into cats, and so she did a kind of taxonomy of the crazy cat lady, which is to say there's a woman holding a cat in the illustration, and there's cats all around her, and there's little, you know, everything is kind of detailed as to what's in her hands, you know, treats and a camera for pictures and catnip, and there's dirty kitty litter on the ground next to her, and it's just a very funny way to approach doing an entry, which is to say just doing it graphically as opposed to text. But I also, you know, there's like a lot of fun stuff to read here, whether it's jokey or whether it's serious. But that tends to be my favorite entry in the whole book, but maybe because I identify with it so closely.
Well, but there's a double-edged thing there, isn't it? It's kind of a funny thing, but also it's the new model stereotype for what people might used to call a spinster or an old maid.
Right, right. Yeah, well, funnily enough, we do have a whole sidebar on spinsters, or at least like famous spinsters of history, and then I believe there's also an entry on what the concept of the term spinster means. But this crazy cat lady illustration was a loving look at a kind of stereotype, as opposed to furthering the stereotype. I think that there are a lot of people who identify with the woman depicted in this illustration, so. You know, just like the word spinster has a negative connotation and the phrase crazy cat lady does, it certainly doesn't in this book.
Here's one that some people around the office liked, inhibitions, and I'll read from it. Mm-hmm. Things that usually keep us from dancing on bars, punching people we have to share public transportation with, telling our bosses what we really think of them, and wearing pajama bottoms to cocktail parties. Things that sometimes keep us from approaching attractive people, asking for raises we deserve, and otherwise taking risks that might pay off big in the long run. Kind of another double-edged one there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there were about 30 different people who wrote entries for the book, and they were all, as my friend calls them, Jezebel adjacent. So either they worked for the site, or they had worked for the site, or they had contributed to the site at some point. And so, you know, it's really interesting to see what everyone came up with. And they were given assignments kind of based on their interests. You know, so someone who has an interest in 20th century female writers was and really, you know, let's say hates popular culture or at least hates celebrity culture wasn't going to be given an entry on Lindsay Lohan. but, you know, but that particular entry, you know, it's funny because I'm forgetting who wrote what. And I think a lot of the writers are forgetting what they wrote. So I can't give the person who wrote that credit, unfortunately, unless I go look in my computer file. But it's fun to see how people interpreted different things.
I like how you interpreted catfight, which is, you know, everyone says that in culture today, but it ends with, you know, the word we use when we want to belittle an argument between two women.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a point to it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it's certainly a phrase or a term that I used when I was much younger. I think I didn't understand the gendered implications behind it. But, you know, when I became aware of that, when I was in my early 20s, I stopped doing that because there seems to be a certain sort of glee in that term, like the idea of women arguing or the idea of women having strong opinions. And I think that women oftentimes are mocked for having strong opinions or they're pilloried for it. And I think that, you know, both of those things, you find that in that phrase, catfight, because women are, you know, women may love cats, but we're nothing like cats.
There are cat ladies, but women are not like cats.
Right. Check.
You also pay tribute to a lot of historical and pop culture icons throughout the book. Any that you want to give a shout out to?
I had a lot of fun with some of the women, some of the female visual artists who I didn't really know a lot about. Like certainly I've heard of Jenny Holzer, and I know a little bit about her work, but you know, having an entry written on her and then going through her her archives or of art and trying to pick an image that would go alongside her entry, I think was really fun for me. And I think it was really fun for the other writers who did that as well, because we wanted to acknowledge people, women mostly, who are either, you know, famous in the present or the past. But, you know, it's you wouldn't necessarily think that you're going to have visual artists represented in a book like this. And certainly someone called me out for totally neglecting female composers. But it is reflective of what we kind of know collectively as the writers and editors on this book. And we definitely missed a lot of stuff. I mean, I have a Microsoft Word file that must have 20 things on it right now of entries that we forgot to put in there.
For part two, the sequel.
Well, if it sells well enough, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, we could only do so much, and I can't kick myself too much for the things that we left out, just because we did work on it for a long time and very hard, and I think it's I wouldn't call it comprehensive, but it wasn't trying to be. But I do think that there's a lot there for people to chew on.
Would you think that this would be a good gift for someone who's got a teenage daughter?
I would say it would be a good gift for someone who has a teenage daughter if that teenage daughter is, you know. I think over the age of 16 would be good. I'll put it that way.
Adult content.
Yeah.
There's a picture of a placenta, but that shouldn't be the worst thing in there.
It's definitely not the worst thing in there. There are some graphic illustrations that are not sexual in nature, but they are biological in nature. And so, you know, there might be some parents who find a rendering of the female anatomy to be something they don't want their daughters to see. but there's a little bit of an edge to it. But I'd say that a teenager over the age of 16 is probably pretty safe. And you know what? Teenagers are a lot more worldly than they were when I was a teenager, so it's very possible that a 14-year-old would find nothing to blink in this book.
You called it an encyclopedia of lady things, a deliberate play on, you know, lady parts, which I think has been a euphemism that's been kicking around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Are you trying to get people to be just sort of, I don't know, less freaked out by things that have to do with women, to bring them, you know, in all of their glory into the spotlight?
Yeah, and actually that's why, you know, I would say that we included things in the book and have included on the site illustrations, like I just mentioned, that are of the female anatomy, or just being kind of bawdy or unapologetic about being human and being female. we like to, as they say, offer up too much TMI in posts. And you know, the site's kind of notorious for doing that historically, for having some very personal posts put up that were fairly graphic in nature, usually very funny. But there's really nothing to be ashamed of. And I think, you know, young women, at least when I was young, we were socialized to kind of believe that our bodies were both for public consumption, but also that they were gross. And you know, you see that in the marketing of products towards women, whether it's like, feminine deodorants and stuff like that. I'm just not a believer that women should be ashamed of their bodies. And I think a lot of women don't really know their bodies that well. So we like to just kind of throw it all out there.
All right. Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Anna Holmes, creator of Jezebel.com. And her new book, in the book of the whole website, is called The Book of Jezebel.
Coming up, why do bugs gross us out so much? Our next guest studies insects, but he kind of fears them, too. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.